For the week of January 4th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 263, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
I can see that you have a little bit of a twinge to your voice. Now, how y'all doing,
Sperling?
Now, is that what Santa brought you over the holiday?
No, actually, I was traveling all over before today. So since our last show, I spent like 4 or 5 days on the road. I was in Atlanta and then St. Petersburg, Florida, then Orlando, Florida, then Gainesville, Florida, then back to Atlanta. And now I'm here in Birmingham just in time for our first show of 2015.
So you're on tour, basically.
I am on tour, just like One Direction.
Oh, and we'll explain why that's important a little later on, won't we?
That's right. What else will we talk about?
We're going to talk about, actually, on this week's show, the year that was, and that year, of course, being 2014. With a week off between Christmas and New Year's, there is usually, well, I guess, little entertainment industry news to speak of, so the media often does a little navel-gazing by tallying up box office grosses for the past 12 months and comparing them to previous years. Guess what? They're down. Except apparently in China and France. There's no need to worry, though, and we'll explain why. The music industry didn't have a great year either, at least not when it comes to sales of either physical or digital music. Though there may be a silver lining in last year's sales figures for the music business, unfortunately, it just doesn't pay as much. Naturally, we'll bring you up to date on the Sony Pictures cyber attack and how the studio's scheduled impromptu release of The Interview fared. You see what I did there, Michael? Scheduled impromptu?
I did.
Okay. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world, not just North America. We get our figures from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull figures from The Hollywood Reporter and Variety, The LA Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, the finale to The Lord of the Rings, Sextuplet. What do you call a six movie series?
Sextuplet.
Sextuplet.
Wait a second.
Sounds naughty.
That sounds like a different kind of movie, actually.
Stop. So it's three Lord of the Rings films, three Hobbit movies. This one grossed $75 million over the weekend. It's at $722 million worldwide. Obviously, it's doing great. And this is a period where like every day is like a Saturday, where movies make a lot of money. So you can't judge them by their opening day numbers necessarily, because some movies which looked a little weak are doing all right. And number two around the world is Night at the Museum. Is that the third in the series or the second?
The third in the series. And from what I can tell, probably the last.
Well, I should imagine. It grossed $40 million worldwide. And it's at $182 million. And number three is Exodus, Gods and Kings. That's sort of a remake of the Ten Commandments. It stars Christian Bale. It grossed $35 million over the weekend, and it just passed the $200 million mark. It is in 52 territories. I'm not sure what big territories it has left, but it needs to make a lot more money to break into profitability. And number four around the world is Penguins of Madagascar, $25 million that made. It's at $270 million worldwide. And number five is Big Hero 6. This is another movie that cost a fair amount to make. I mean, Big Hero 6 cost, I think it was $165 million. Animated films can be very expensive. It grossed $25 million over the weekend. It's at $380 million worldwide. But, you know, it's just starting to get closer and closer to profitability. It comes out in North America on DVD and Blu-ray in February. So it's towards the end of its run here. I don't know what territories it has left. I think it has China left. And that will certainly be a good market for it, because Asia is a strong market for this movie, since the manga, the story it's based on, has elements of mangas and other Asian properties. It's at $378 million worldwide, but if it cost $160 million to make, it's still got another $100 million to go before it can claim itself as a hit.
Yeah.
At number six is a Chinese drama, The Taking of Tiger Mountain. I think it's the first time we've talked about this film, but it's been in theaters for a few weeks. It's a Chinese movie. It grossed $23 million. It's about to pass the $100 million mark. It's only playing in China. And it is a new drama by Hark Sui, or Sui Hark. I can never remember which name comes first. He's a well-known director, has been for many years. And it's about Chinese soldiers fighting bandits during the revolution.
You know, something we all do on a Saturday.
That's right. At number seven is the perfect Christmas Day movie, Unbroken. Nothing Says Christmas Like Torture. And Unbroken grossed $20 million over the weekend. It's about to pass $100 million worldwide. And it's been doing quite well in North America. It's number three this week in the North American box office. And almost all its money has come here. It costs $60 million to make. It's at $100 million. It's clearly going to get to $180 million. So this is going to be a commercial and potentially critical success for Angelina Jolie. The reviews were mixed, but it is still in the hunt for Oscar nominations. I saw it. I was bored by it.
Yeah, well, it looks like one of those movies where you're like, wow, look at the grandiose boredom that you can have.
Well, it just was, you know, it was the book. There was the stuff that happened in the book, and there it was on screen, but I felt very little. But yeah. My family liked it. They enjoyed it. They had a good time. So there you go. Another movie that families are enjoying is Into the Woods, the Rob Marshall musical. It grossed $20 million over the weekend. It, too, is at about to pass $100 million worldwide, and that also has given good word of mouth. It's doing very well in North America, and, you know, it looks like it's going to be another hit.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because it's a Stephen Sondheim musical, and as you know, Sondheim is a bit of an acquired taste.
No, he's not. He's one of the great composers of all time, having delivered masterful hits like West Side Story and Gypsy and countless shows on his own, like the Pulitzer Prize-winning Sunday in the Park with George, and this is his most accessible, friendliest show of all time. Typically, he makes a show, he releases it, and then critics like it, but it doesn't become a big hit until it's revived. And then it's revived and people love it. Into the Woods has been revived multiple times. It's a very well-known property. It's based on fairy tales. It's very accessible. It's his most popular show by some measures. So no, this is not an acquired taste at all. Anybody can appreciate the show. Whether the movie is any good, of course, is another issue.
I'll ask our listeners to Company is another Sondheim musical, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
Company, Passion, Sunday in the Park with George, Follies, and on and on and on.
Yeah. Listen to some of them and get back to me. Not he's West Side Story. Not
he's
West
written some of the most popular tunes of all time. Sending the Clowns.
Yes. And do you know what that's from?
Not a little, Night Music, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Exactly. Yeah,
which is a perfect jewel of a musical. One of the great musicals of all time. And was just on Broadway recently, I think, with Catherine Zeta-Jones. Oh, that obscure thing. At number nine is Woman in Black 2, a sequel to The Woman in Black. The first movie was a surprise hit. The second movie is a not-so-big surprise, blah. It made $18 million. It's doing okay. It was probably cheap to make, but it doesn't include Daniel Radcliffe. It doesn't include the elements that made the first film sort of an underground success story. And it's probably cost very little to make, and they're just going to trade on the name and make what bucks they can. That's Hollywood for you, right?
Oh, I think we'll find that out with the year's grosses, absolutely.
Okay, at number 10 is Seventh Son. This is a would-be launch to a fantasy series. It's based on a series of novels called The Last Apprentice series by Joseph Delaney. They somehow came up with the name Seventh Son because I think the hero is the seventh son of a seventh son, and therefore he is ripe for training in the magical arts. It stars Ben Barnes and Jeff Bridges as his crusty old mentor. They opened this one overseas. It comes out in the U.S. in February. It grossed $22 million so far. It's at $18 million this weekend, and clearly it opened on like a Wednesday or something. It's in 24 territories, so it doesn't sound like a great start, but I don't know how big those territories are. It's probably not a big-budget movie. We'll have to see where it ends up.
Well, some of those territories are quite small, Malaysia, Peru, etc.
At number 11 is Ode to My Father. This is a South Korean drama. I think we talked about it before. This is the sprawling, multi-decade story of modern Korea told through the eyes of one family. It grossed $18 million, and it's at $55 million worldwide. Then there's Annie. This is a movie in North America. Terrible reviews. This is one of the pirated movies, one of the movies that was pirated from Sony, right?
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Annie was definitely one of the four.
Oh, Annie. I thought you were still on Ode to My Father. Yes. Annie was pirated. And you know what? I don't think that the piracy actually affected it.
Well, sure. I mean, it was a, you know, I mean, I don't know how you could say that. You never know what would have happened if there hadn't been piracy. I doubt it's not the type of film that is a big pirate type movie.
Exactly.
It's not a movie. So it may be available online, but the families that want to see Annie are not the same ones that are stealing movies online and putting them, watching them on their iPhones. So yes, of course not. But it grossed $15 million. It's at $90 million worldwide. What did this movie cost? Annie cost about $65 million. So despite poor reviews, it looks like another success story for the Smith family. This maybe that we can all forget about that horrible New York Times Magazine interview with the two kids where they just sounded like the loopiest Southern California nuts that you can ask for.
And they're my new neighbors. They live right down the street now.
Hi, everybody. You have the longest street in L.A., Everybody lives on your street.
Well, Calabasas, you know, what can I say? I mean, they live right off of Mulholland. Of course, let's put it this way. Their neighborhood.
One of their houses. Yeah,
their neighborhood ain't anything like my neighborhood. That's for sure.
Well, if they live down the street, it is your neighborhood.
Well, they're behind the gates. I'm in the surf kingdom down here with no gates.
So the Smith family bought a new home in L.A.
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder why. And number 13 is The Imitation Game, another Oscar hopeful. $14 million over the weekend, $60 million worldwide. So that's really shaping up into a solid independent film success story. Hunger Games, of course, is a massive hit. That's about to pass $700 million worldwide. And at number 15 worldwide is Paddington. When does that open up in North America? February, January, March? I don't know.
I don't know. That's a good question because I thought it was going to open up over Christmas and apparently not.
Well, it just passed the $100 million mark worldwide. So Paddington is looking to be a success story. So that's what the movies that are big hits around the world. Was there any notable story in North America? There's been some big independent releases like Selma and American Sniper are doing very strong in limited release here in the U.S. So they're going to open wider soon, hoping to capitalize on Oscar nominations, I imagine. I know Selma goes wide January 9th. I'm not sure when American Sniper does, but they've both been hot tickets, you know, in limited release. Big Eyes, not doing so well. It's doing okay. Yeah. You know, it probably didn't cost a lot to make. That's at about $10 million in North America. And Wild is really, it's doing all right, too. I'm sure this was a low-budget movie. This is the Reese Witherspoon film based on the memoir by Cheryl Strayed, and it has passed the $25 million mark in the U.S. So it didn't have a big opening, but audiences turned out for it. It's an older audience-type movie, a female-centric film. Of course, it's a movie for everyone if you like it. I didn't think it was very good, but, you know, a good movie is a good movie. And Wild has found its audience slowly but surely, and it's at $25 million.
Paddington will open on January 16th. Here in the United States.
Well, there you go. Just 2 weeks away. Next weekend is Selma, and the weekend after that is Paddington.
Yeah, Selma was notably not in the Producers Guild Award nominations.
That's right. The Producers Guild nominations were announced, but we know why, don't we?
Yes, because they didn't actually send screeners out.
That's right. If you don't send out screeners, they don't vote for your movie because they haven't seen it, literally. I mean, it's not even in most theaters yet. So they do have some Hollywood screenings, but if you don't get those discs out, people just don't keep it in mind. You really have to do the discs. What was the other movie that got hurt by not having their discs out in time? There was one other film. It was, it was Selma and, they didn't get to the PGA either. So they didn't, to SAG as well. That's why they weren't part of SAG nominations. They didn't get the Producers Guild. And I think other movies that were snubbed were Unbroken and Into the Woods. Those were some movies that might have been on the PGA list. There's no particular reason that we know of why they weren't. But the movies they picked are sort of the ones that everybody's talking about. American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, Foxcatcher, Gone Girl, Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Nightcrawler, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. You can take those movies and substitute at least one or two of the others, like Selma or Unbroken, and that's going to end up being your list for the Oscars. So it's a year where there are not any big hits in the mix. Maybe Interstellar could get in there. Gone Girl is a big commercial hit, relatively speaking. Those are probably the two best chances because we're probably not going to see Guardians of the Galaxy get in there.
Absolutely not. I don't see that happening.
Well, you know, but it could have a really strong fan base. It will get a lot of technical nominations. And, you know, it is one of the most popular films of the year, had great reviews. It deserves to be in the Oscar mix. It's just not going to make it because it's a fun, silly comic book movie. But it should be in the talk, and it should probably be on the list. Well, as far as Oscars, it's not my pick for one of the best movies of the year. But if you're talking about the big 10 movies of the year and you want people to turn into your Oscar show, Guardians of the Galaxy should be on the list. God knows they'll get Chris Pratt to handle an award.
Well, Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, it was a hit here in North America. I think it was a hit worldwide, too. I think in China, it made $100 million, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. It made a ton of money. And, of course, this was a big year for the Chinese box office. We'll get to North American box office in a moment. But we always look at the world and the worldwide box office. I don't have a total for that yet, but China certainly had a great year. It surged 36%, that's a huge jump, to $4.76 billion. In like a blink of an eye, this sucker is going to be at $10 billion. So China is growing by leaps and bounds. That is a big new market with a lot of growth potential.
Yeah, I mean, I always go back to, I can't remember a couple years ago, I can't remember the name of the show, but there was some television show in China that was the most popular television show in China that when it was on, the country ground to a halt, and it was on once a week. And the number of people watching that show, 600 million people
Well, I wouldn't think there'd be that many people with access to a TV.
I thought the same thing, but apparently they would gather around in restaurants.
In the village.
Yeah. And so 600 million people would watch that. That's twice as many, or nearly twice as many people that live in the United States.
That's right. We never had that. That's two-thirds of the entire country.
Yes.
So that's a very high number. That would be like having 200 million people watch. 200 million people don't watch the Super Bowl.
Right,
exactly. To put that in perspective. But, you know, China is a big new market with a lot of growth. They're building a lot of screens. But that's not the only country that's doing well, is it? Some mature markets are doing great as well.
That's right. France, the box
office. Great as well.
You must be talking about France, though.
Oui.
Okay. So, yeah, that in France, box office rose 8%. But the big news here is it's not because of Hollywood films. It's because of two films early on in the year, both of which were comedies and both of which we talked about.
Which were they?
I think one was Serial Weddings. Now, this was when we talked about it.
We didn't know what to call it. This was the God, what have you done to me or something like that,
yeah,
right?
So, all of my kids are marrying people of different faiths.
They had four daughters or five daughters, and each one married someone from a different faith, a Chinese, Jewish, Muslim. So they ended up marrying people of four different faiths, four different backgrounds. I think Buddhist was one of them, right?
Yes.
It was a crazy comedy. I'm sure it'll get remade here.
I'm sure, you know, Harvey Weinstein has already either bought the rights or I think he did actually.
And what was the other one? What was the other movie?
I knew you would ask that, which is why I'm opening the story right now. So Serial was one, and Superchondriac, a gag Latin buddy comedy between a crazed germaphobe and his doctor.
Howie Mandel making the remake.
Exactly. 34 million euros or $42.5 million. That's actually not bad. And then, of course, you have Lucy coming in with a Luc Besson, Scarlett Johansson movie.
So the French box office was up almost 8%. So that's great news. And you want to see, you want a healthy local box office because that generates remake rights and movies that can translate and do well around the world, even without having to be remade into English. So it's not like France benefited at the expense of Hollywood. France creating homegrown hits is a really important, healthy part of the box office. And Hollywood loves to see that. They're probably partnered with those movies, or one of them at least. So, you know, everybody benefits when that happens.
That's right. I mean, it's I always go back to Neil Gaiman a couple of years ago saying, look, if you want your kids to read, let them read what they like, what they want. Just get them reading. It doesn't matter what they're reading. They just need
comic books, junk,
just let them read
whatever you think is junk. Yeah, let them read.
And eventually their tastes will change. Now, there's, you know, some controversy or some opposition to that, but that said,
I don't know any opposition to that. I don't know any teacher or librarian or person who doesn't say, hey, anything that they're reading is good.
Yeah, I would agree with
that. Who disagrees with that?
There was an article in the New Yorker called The Percy Jackson Problem.
The kids were reading too much Percy Jackson?
I guess so, yeah. And so, you know, there's some pushback against that, but I would say, look, just get him going to the movies. Get him in the habit of going to the cinema, period.
Right. And so what can we learn from the French box office? You don't have to be a new market in order to have growth. That's a good sign. Or to have a good year. What else?
Don't look at a single year. As Julian Marcel of Box Office Magazine wrote, and I think this was actually on LinkedIn, believe it or not, even though he's the editor-in-chief of Box Office Magazine, he says, simply because admissions are down doesn't mean that the exhibition industry is an irreparable tailspin. And this is the best part. Discerning a trend from any given year is as effective as illustrating global warming based on a hot November.
So is he saying don't put too much faith in the fact that the box office in France was up 8%?
He's saying
be wary of that.
He's saying just because it's down in North America and certain Western markets that are considered...
Oh, he wasn't talking about France.
He was, but meaning that it was down before, that the French box office was down the previous year. So in other words, you go down, you go up. You can't look at one year
You want to look at overall historic trends. And
that's right.
We've said many times before, the overall historic trend in North America is that people spend a lot more money on movies than they ever did before. Until the early 80s, the only way to see a movie was to go to the theater. You know, maybe once in a while you could catch it on late night TV, but suddenly now you have an explosion of DVD and Blu-ray and rental and video on demand and digital downloads and streaming. So the pie is so much bigger now. And yet, despite that, annual box office overall long term has been going up. It's basically keeping pace with the population growth. Ticket sales are keeping pace with the population growth. People aren't suddenly going to twice as many movies as they did in the 80s, but they are maintaining that movie-going habit despite the fact that they can access any movie made in history at the touch of a button. And that's kind of remarkable because they're spending another $30 billion to see movies in other ways, and yet they're still going to the box office. So if you look at this year, 2014 was not a great year. It was the lowest ticket sales, and that's the best measurement, the lowest ticket sales since 1995. Actual number of tickets sold were 1.26 billion tickets, and that is the lowest figure since 1995 when Hollywood sold 1.21 billion tickets in North America.
Well, and I believe John Fithian of the National Association of Theater Owners, he's the head of that trade organization, he said on January 1st of 2014, he wrote an op-ed piece for The Hollywood Reporter kind of decrying the fact that all of these big, huge movies have been pushed to 2015 and out of 2014. So he kind of predicted this in a way, saying, guys, you got to spread the love around between 2014 and 2015. Don't jam-pack 2015. We're not going to be able to sustain it.
Well, as he's probably looking at the summer, especially the summer of 2014 was down 15% over 2013. But as we talked about before, that's because they released about half as many movies. So what they basically got rid of this year were the flops. There were no big flops this summer. Virtually every movie made money. There were like 13 or 14 big budget Hollywood movies, and like 11 of them made money.
Right.
So what they didn't do was release a bunch of flops like The Lone Ranger and earlier in that year, John Carter of Mars and so on. That's not great for theaters. They just want bums in seats. They don't care if the movie actually makes money or not. I mean, of course they want hits because that makes people happy, but they just want audiences to go to the movies. But for studios, you know what? They were really smart this year. So yeah, overall attendance in the summer was lower because there were fewer movies, but almost all of them made money. So they got rid of the flops. You know, you can't look at that long term as a bad thing. Obviously, you don't want to release one movie a year and have it make $4 trillion. You want a range of movies. But, you know, the summer was down. Sure, it was. They released 10 fewer films than last year. And most of the ones that they released were hits. So, you know, that's really not a bad thing.
And I will predict now. Okay.
Oh, of course.
And
of course.
You can take this to the bank.
Please, of course.
Now, you know what I'm about to say, right?
Yes.
That this year, 2015, will be the biggest box office on record for North America, if not globally.
Globally?
Yes.
Well, globally will definitely go up. Globally always goes up.
Right.
We don't have any global figures yet for the global box office,
no,
but that's been growing by leaps and bounds for years. That isn't going to stop anytime soon. But yeah, next year has so many big franchise movies. We know it's going to set a record at the box office. The real question will be ticket sales. What can we look at as far as ticket sales? That will be fascinating to see if we can get a contemporary peak number. I think the highest number in modern times from like the mid-80s on is 2002 when we sold 1.57 billion tickets. It's possible we could match that or beat that. That would be, you know, a new record. So you look at box office, you look at this and that, and you can say, hey, it was not a great year. You know, it's the lowest year at box office gross since the last time we set a record at the box office was over a decade ago. That was 2002 when we grossed $12 billion in North America. That was a record. You know, it's been over a decade since we set a record at the box office. You say, oh my God, that's awful. That's terrible. That's horrible. But you adjust for inflation. And you look at the highest grossing years adjusted for inflation. Number one is 2002. That's $12 billion adjusted for inflation, mind you. It's not the actual figures that were made that year. That's adjusted for inflation. But then you look at the next 10 movies, 2003, 2006, 2004, 2009, 2010, 2001, 2012, 2000. Guess what? The last 10 years are the 10 highest grossing years in modern times, adjusted for inflation. So, yes, you had this wild peak year in 2002. We haven't set a record since then. But when you do adjust for inflation, when you look at how we're doing, the last decade was filled with, you know, huge grossing years.
And I'm sure there are people who would argue, and somewhat rightfully so, that, hey, you know, ticket prices were much higher then, so even adjusting for inflation doesn't count. Well, okay, fine.
That's what adjusting for inflation does. How did they make that money? Some movies, they charge more, absolutely.
Yeah.
They charge more money. There's more premium pricing, all that stuff. And, you know, I don't like that. But that's true. You know, it was the lowest grossing year since 1998. But you know what? Actually, there's a ton of success stories in the last decade. So if you look at the big trend, this year was down. You're going to have down years. When you release half as many movies in the summer, you're going to have a down summer. And overall, you know, the last decade, ticket sales rise, keeping pace with population. Box office rises, keeping pace with population. You know, box office is very healthy. And that doesn't even include all the other areas where you make money.
one of those areas is Netflix. And granted, we're not talking about that now, but something struck me. You know, for me, it's always about people going and paying at the box office for a theatrical release, going to the cinema. That's what really matters to me and what's important.
Well, that drives the business.
And it drives the habit of movie going. And over the break, I was with a number of people and in a rental house and hooked the television up to a Netflix account, somebody's Netflix account.
Sure, sure.
And there were several people in this home and several people coming and going in this home, all of whom are incredibly educated, you know, graduate degrees, in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, all the way up to, you know, 60s. And they were shocked that so much of Netflix was free. They said, oh, wow, you can watch, you know, Marco Polo, which is an original. Oh, you can watch this other movie.
What do you mean free?
Well, they weren't familiar with the whole streaming of Netflix. They knew the DVD aspect of it, but they weren't really all that familiar with how you would hook up Netflix to your TV and that you could just kind of scan through and pick the movie you want to watch, select it.
So you have really old friends.
I thought the same thing. I thought, where have you all been? Do you not read the newspaper? Do you not?
They're not the audience to be early adapters and cut the cord and all that. They're paying $120 for their cable bill, and they don't think twice about it.
Well, they do think twice. They certainly
they
have.
They don't like it, but they're not. But they do it.
Yeah, and I guess that, you know, one person who is in mid-40s said, "Why would anybody go to the movies again?" And I thought, "Wow, okay, so we're now reaching people who obviously are not too swift on the uptake here, even despite their education, and yet." They're now saying that it's again.
Well, but it's not true. We know we movies that that's exactly what we say is not happening. You know, that's the fear. Radio is going to kill movies. Television was going to kill movies. Streaming and cable is going to kill movies. It's not happening. It could happen at some point in the future. But right now, what we see is despite all these other options, people still go to the movies because it's a great experience. The seats are better than ever. The screen and sound is better than ever. The experience is really good. Popcorn and soda is too high priced, way too high priced. So people either sneak in their own food or don't buy anything. I rarely buy any food or soda at a movie theater anymore. And I used to buy stuff every time. But they have a good time because you can't enjoy Guardians of the Galaxy as much. No matter how good your sound system is, you're going to have a lot more fun seeing Guardians of the Galaxy in a movie theater with a big crowd. A lot of people downloaded the interview, right? They streamed it or they bought it online over the holidays. I bet they would have had more fun seeing that in a crowded movie theater.
Well, certainly I agree with you. I mean, yeah. Do you want to move into Our friends over at Sony, but very
quickly, you know, we talked about the other pieces of the pie. There's going to the movies. There's also home entertainment purchases. That's DVDs and Blu-rays. That's rentals. That's kiosks like Redbox. That's presumably streaming and VOD. They describe home entertainment as $17.8 billion in North America. And this year, digital downloads alone set a record topping $1.5 billion from digital downloads. Every studio is trying to encourage people to download a movie. Don't buy the Blu-ray. They make the digital download available weeks before the movie comes out on DVD and Blu-ray. They are begging you, hey, don't go to the store and buy a disc. Just download it. You'll be so much happier. And that's working. People are starting to migrate towards it. $1.5 billion. Part of that, of course, was the interview.
Yes, well, a small portion of that, though it's kind of untrackable since there's no way to track VOD other than listening to what the studio says.
Well,
there is
if you're the studio.
Yes.
Yeah. They don't want to tell you, but yes.
Yeah, and they said, look, we made $15 million on showing the interview on VOD. Now, before we even get to that, did you want to talk about all these, the top ad spends for movies?
No, not really. That didn't interest me.
Okay, well... All right,
I mean,
we
people
talk
bought
about
a lot of TV ads, and it's not always the movies that are the big hits. Sometimes they spend a lot of money to advertise movies that don't click at the box office. Big surprise, but it ends up that they raise visibility. And when that movie comes out on VOD or DVD, people remember the name, and then they end up renting it.
Yes.
And now, so it's not necessarily money wasted.
Did you go see the interview in a theater, or did you rent it?
I did neither, but in driving around the South, I was using a Wi-Fi connection in a Wendy's or a McDonald's. I don't know where I was sitting. There was two old coots, I tell you. They were coots talking. I was in the middle of nowhere. And we're going, you know that movie, The Interview? He's saying to the other guy, yeah, I got it. Yeah, I was telling people that'll be on the porn sites any minute now. I don't know what he means, but like somehow pirate sites where he usually gets porn, he apparently said, I knew it would be on there. And you know what? I went home and there it was on there. I took it down. I haven't watched it yet, but I got it. So he stole a copy of the interview on a porn that pirated porn website to make a statement against North Korea. So it's another strike for freedom.
Yeah, well, okay.
Talk about, you know, this was a cootie old man. So they did it. He knew how to get a copy of the interview. He could teach your friends a thing or two.
Yeah, I mean, it just boggled my mind. But needless to say, I don't know if we need to rehash any of this.
Well, what's the latest with the Sony hack?
I mean, where do you begin? Where do you end? It doesn't end. The latest, if you work backwards, is that Kaz Hirai, who is the CEO of Sony, the whole company, so Sony Pictures, he's basically Sony Electronics. He is, you know, you can't get any higher in Sony than Kaz Hirai.
He's the head of the company.
Yes.
You can't get any higher. He's the head. Okay.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's...
and he spoke at the CES, which is?
The Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where they kind of...
Tout stuff.
Yeah, they tout all the 4K televisions and the ultra-high defs and the high dynamic ranges and the blah, blah,
blah. He was scheduled to speak there, and he needed to address the issue because it would have looked silly if he didn't. And what did he say? He said, oh, well, it was a terrible thing, and thank you everyone who helped us release this movie. It was very bland.
Yes. But he did. But now, mind you, English is his second language, so...
Well, no, I'm not criticizing his English. It was an intellectual choice not to talk about the movie much or make a big, bold statement, so it has nothing to do with his, you know, ability to speak in English. He chose really just to deliver a very quick, bland comment about the movie, but he did address it finally. But what I thought was funny was that Sony was touting all their 4K stuff, the 4K TVs and the 4K this and the 4K that, and then Netflix's Greg Peters got on there, and he's partnered with Sony, and they've got a lot of 4K offerings, but what he did was he went nuts about high dynamic range, and he said, 4K is great, but when consumers see HDR, they're going to be blown away.
We've always said that. It's not about more pixels. It's about better pixels.
But I'm sure Sony was thrilled to hear him poo-pooing 4K.
Yeah.
They're still hoping we're all going to get excited by that format. So that's the Sony chief weighed in. The president weighed in. Obama did announce that there would be new sanctions against North Korea for the hack. And I have to say, I think there's more traction in the idea that security experts and other people are saying, you know what, they really haven't made a good case that North Korea is responsible for this. Gawker did a roundup of all the different articles. Other websites did. You know, when I speak to people, it's even techie people, I mentioned, do you think North Korea did? They're like, well, of course they did. And I go, well, really? And then I send them the articles and they go, oh, wow, maybe they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you can't take it at face value. Yes, there were many things that we didn't know about that the FBI and other sources will not release, as they should not, because it kind of speaks to what they're
doing.
Right,
but if you can't privately go to people and say, hey, look, here's what we know. You know, if they have a trouble, they have a perception trouble that a lot of tech people are going, this really doesn't look like North Korea. And in fact, one security firm, Norse Corporation, did their own investigation and then met with the FBI. The FBI felt obliged to meet with them. Clearly, they're not a joke of a group. You know, not trying to gain some. They met with them, so clearly they felt they needed to. And they gave them all the info they had about this insider with an online name of Lana. And they looked at her working with pro-piracy hacktivists. And they, of course, we know it's at least in part an inside job. That doesn't rule out North Korea. But they identified a foreigner employee, noting angry posts she made on social media about the layoffs in Sony and her links to hacking groups in Europe and Asia and on and on and on. And they shared all this information with the FBI. And the FBI said, thank you very much. We still think it's North Korea.
Right, exactly. We can't go back on our word. It's North Korea.
The only thing that confuses me is I think Obama probably isn't aware or is slowly becoming aware that other people are questioning this. I doubt he has any idea that there was any potential that it wasn't North Korea. He was told it's North Korea. And now I feel like they're doubling down on stupidity and don't want to admit that they were wrong because I can't think of any valid reason why they would want to gin up a controversy with North Korea if they didn't have to. So I don't know why they made the leap in the first place. I think it was probably just incompetence. And now I think they're unwilling to backtrack or acknowledge any potential for gray in this. So, we'll have to see. This could look really bad in a year if it comes out that it was somebody else. They'll look stupid, but people, I guess, will have moved on by then and not really care.
Well, with hacks and cyber attacks, and I don't mean to rhyme there, but I know some people like to call it a hack. Others like to call it a cyber attack.
Oh, right. Because hacking is not necessarily evil, right?
Correct.
So you shouldn't call it hacking, right?
Yeah. So a cyber attack, which is specifically an attack, as opposed to a hack, which is a workaround. Mm-hmm. And attribution for these types of crimes is always difficult because once perpetrated, the code is out there in the wild and anybody can now use it to to do
and
the
that's what
same
they
exact,
do, right? And
that's exactly what they do. So it's like, oh, well, it must be North Korea because the tool they used is the exact same tool. Well, guess what? We all have that tool now. I could do it if I want. Well, maybe not me personally, but anybody can now use that tool. Like Stuxnet is out there, which was another virus that was used by cyber attackers. It's out there. People can use it. The antivirus companies go in and they start trying to patch systems using software. It's not always effective. In this case, obviously wasn't. What really kind of underscores the fact that this probably had something to do with an insider is the speed at which the amount of data was taken, and their knowledge of the networks involved. So they didn't have to spend a lot of time going, okay, we're in the front door. Where's the bathroom? Where's the living room? They knew where everything in the house was and knew exactly what to take, how to take it, and how quickly they could get it without doing what most cyber attackers do, which is they kind of have to poke around in private for a long time trying to figure out the lay of the land and then steal all the data. And usually they try and get out without causing a lot of notice. They don't want people to know that they were there.
Well, that's people who are doing stunts. If your intent is to destroy, that's a wholly different world. Yeah.
Obviously, in this case, the intent was to destroy because they actually made some of their systems not only unusable, but they'll never be able to recover portions of those systems. According to the Wall Street Journal, who ran a very interesting article, they interviewed Michael Linton, who went through, you know, not hour by hour, but certainly milestone by milestone, what was going on day by day during this whole incident.
Well, we expressed sympathy for Sony last week. It was a no-win situation. They certainly bungled it to a degree PR-wise and statements that they made, but there were almost no good choices for them to make. They just did it in a poor way that didn't do well. You know, I'm annoyed by their backtracking on the release of the movie. You know, now Linton's like, oh, it's always been our intention to have a national platform to release the film. And that's just a complete lie because a few days earlier he'd said no VOD site would touch the movie. And of course, they all were willing to release the movie. So that was just not true. So, you know, they've bungled things here and there, but there is still some interesting stuff coming out. People claim, oh, you're just dealing in gossip. You shouldn't report on these stories. Well, you know what? The one real interesting story that came out this week is that a lot of studios announced and the MPAA announced big settlements with pirate websites. We've talked about piracy a lot today. And in the past, they've gone to websites, they've sued them, and they've said, we're going to get $80 million from the website Hotfile. Or we're going to get, you know, because they did all this downloading of movies and TV shows, they're going to pay us $80 million. And documents that we found during this cyber attack show that no, and not true at all. In fact, the MPA got about $4 million, but they all agreed to claim it was $80 million in a press release just to sort of intimidate other websites. So, you know, that's pretty big news, you know. They're claiming big success stories against pirate websites and lying about the money that they've collected from
them.
And
this came out from documents that were released?
Yes, that came from the Sony hack. Okay. I shouldn't say that. The Sony cyber attack, there were documents between the studios and the studios, the MPAA, we had the link in our show notes, showing that this just wasn't true, that the large, big-ticket settlements that they claimed from Hotfile and some other pirate websites were wildly exaggerated and just done for PR purposes.
Well, certainly you couldn't get enough. I mean, if you didn't know about the interview, as you said, the two old coots at McDonald's knew about it.
Yeah.
Right. So, and it was all this news that about, you know, North Korea and the cyber attack and Sony. I mean, everybody knew about the interview. So that when it was released on December 25th, Christmas Day, or just ahead of Christmas Day, what I went to a few torrent sites just to see, would this film start to appear on those torrent sites? Sure enough, it did. And initially, it was like all the other films. It was around 3,000, 1,000, 2,000 seeds, meaning that's how many machines it was on where you could download it from. By the end of Christmas Day, there were like 75,000 seeds. It was an astronomical amount. By the end of the week, it was reported that it was illegally downloaded. This film was illegally downloaded at least once by two old coots, but 900,000 times.
How does that compare to like other movies over the year, from the year?
Well, Wolf of Wall Street, I guess, was what? I mean, we're
30 million times.
30 million.
Right, but that's not actually that much.
But over an entire year.
Right.
So in 1 week, you know,
right, but it's not going to keep growing.
I don't think
it's not going to come anywhere near Wolf of Wall Street.
No,
so it got a lot of attention, and so people go online and steal a copy.
Right. I mean, the smaller the film, the less piracy occurs with it. Day and date releasing, yeah. Everybody's saying, oh, well, it made $15 million, so this is going to totally change the platform. Everything's changed. The industry's changed because The Interview made $15 million.
Nobody said that.
Well,
nobody smart said that.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. One news outlet will say that, and then another news outlet will come back and actually say, yeah, I don't think so, because A, theaters still aren't going to show something on their screens that you can get at home.
Are you
VOD.
Watching E! News again?
No.
Okay.
No, I agree with you in saying that it really doesn't change much, because unless
it's
it's
a completely unique situation.
It really is. Are you going to actually cause an international incident over every big blockbuster film that you want to release day and date? Because if not, then you're not going to make $15 million on the
Well, if you'd released Unbroken on Christmas Day VOD, you might well have made $15 million.
Yeah, that's
true. It's not a question that it's an unreachable amount of money to make streaming and digital downloads when you release a movie in the theater. The question is whether that's the best thing to do for the industry overall, including the studios with the movie. You know, they probably make more money. The belief is right now you make more money with a window for box office and then a window for cable and streaming and digital and DVD and Blu-ray and TV and pay cable and network showings and all that stuff, right?
That's why they call them distribution channels. That's absolutely right. You make a certain amount of money off of one, and then a certain amount of money off of another. If you offer both access through both channels at the same time, they play off of one another. It's you know, economics 101.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was it was a big week for the box office because people flocked to the movie theaters. They also flocked to Broadway, don't they?
Well, I guess because there's a lot of traveling going on. So New York is kind of crammed and filled, even though I would imagine that Times Square is not a very friendly place. Broadway isn't a very friendly place because it's right near Times Square on New Year's Eve.
Not New Year's Eve. There are shows New Year's Eve, absolutely. People go to the shows on New Year's Eve. You get there early. You know, they have earlier showings on New Year's Eve because when you want to get out and get away because Broadway gets blocked off and all that. But you can come out of your show, get in the subway, and get out of the area if you want. So, I mean, they take that into account as far as when they're blocking off streets. They know there are people who are going to come out of those theaters. And New Year's Eve, people go to Broadway shows. They absolutely do. And then they step outside and they're right in the midst of Times Square. So it's kind of a neat thing, you know, in a way. You show up, you can get into your theater, and you come out, and it may be blocked off. You can always leave, but at least you're there and you're right in the midst of the fun. So some people like to go to a show and then hang out and watch the ball drop.
Now, you know, on New Year's Eve, I was in Idaho, but I watched CNN of all networks for the ball drop, and it was Kathy Griffin and Anderson Cooper. Have you ever seen these two together on New Year's Eve?
No, I have not.
That is the most inappropriately hilarious duo. I mean, because Anderson Cooper's all straight and
nerdy.
And Kathy Griffin is saying, who booked this show? Why are you cutting to the crab in Baltimore? Like, just hilarious, because she's right, calling them out on everything. And it's, I could see why people might hate it, but it's one of those you either love it or you hate it. And yet I couldn't stop watching.
Well, there you go. That's your New Year's Eve. So you didn't go to a Broadway show,
I did
obviously.
Not go to a Broadway show, no.
But a lot of people did. A lot of records were set over the holiday week. There's been 2 weeks now, I think, since we've been off. And it's a big, big time to go to Broadway. And we talk about the $1 million club. That's shows that have grossed more than $1 million in a certain week. Well, during the Christmas week of theater going, 19 shows grossed more than $1 million. And in fact, 3 shows grossed more than $2 million, with Wicked almost grossing $3 million. So a lot of records were set. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, that's been on the boards for about a year. That set a house record. On the Town, I think, hit a new high. It's Only a Play, which stars Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, that set a record. And then What Have I Told You, Sperling, time and time again. How do you set a new record on Broadway? Because you've only got a certain number of seats. How do they set a new box office record for a Broadway show?
Well, everybody knows that you interlock. You open up the same play across the street, and you have the actors run back and forth so that you have more seats. Right?
That's a movie joke, but that's not true. What's the answer?
How do they raise ticket prices? You raise the ticket prices. There's only one way.
Nope, there's 2 ways.
Oh, you
there is
standing
one
room.
Other way. There is one other way. You do more shows.
Oh, yeah.
Most
okay,
of the
that's
time
true.
On Broadway, you have 8 shows a week. And sometimes in the holidays, they do 9 shows a week. And I've seen some like seasonal shows like A Christmas Story or The Grinch or some of them, they do like 10 shows a week or even more because everybody wants to see the holiday show. So some of these shows set new records by adding on an extra performance. It costs a lot more. You got to pay more to the unions and the actors and all that. But there's so much money to be made during Christmas week. So the time of year when we think of having fun and relaxing and being with your family is probably a nightmare if you're an actor in a Broadway show. You got to work, and you got to work harder than ever, and it's just a nightmare.
Now, is Sting still in the last ship? Is he still there doing that?
He is in the last ship, but they're going to shut it down. They just announced they're closing on January 24th. They realize as soon as Sting steps away, it's going to be the winter season, and the show's going to collapse. They're not even going to be able to make it to the Tony nominations. You know, they know the show is probably going to get a Best New Musical nomination. It's not a given, but it's very likely. And they can't even hold on till then to see if they can build up word of mouth. So they are pulling the plug on Sting's The Last Ship. Hopefully he'll work and do another show because I thought it was good. There are some other new shows in the works here, like Honeymoon in Vegas, a musical version of that movie. This one stars Tony Danza. That is not doing well in previews either. They're giving away tickets practically, but it's still only 75% full. People are just not interested in this show. But Jake Gyllenhaal, his sister's on Broadway or was on Broadway in The Real Thing. They overlap just a little bit. And now he's on Broadway in Constellations. And that's discounted, but it's very full. It's about 90% full. So there's a lot of interest in that show. So, you know, it's the end of one year, the beginning of a new year. The Christmas season is always a big high for everyone. Now we hit the winter months. So there's going to be a couple weeks or a month or two of pretty slow box office, followed by a clutch of new shows and then the Tony nominations. So we'll see where we end up. But hopefully one of them would love to become like Mamma Mia, because over the holidays, that became the 8th longest running show in Broadway history, passing Beauty and the Beast. It's been on Broadway for 13 years, 5,500 performances. That's a lot of Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia.
That's not exactly right because they're Swedish, but yes, Mamma Mia.
Okay. I don't know. I'm not going to do the Swedish accent.
Oh, thank you.
So I guess, you know, I don't know, eighth longest running show, 13. I didn't know it was 13 years. My kids love the soundtrack to that movie. They love the movie. They do not think that Meryl Streep was miscast.
The soundtrack, I don't think she was miscast. It just wasn't a good movie. Of course she wasn't miscast. She's the right age. She can sing. Who says she's miscast?
Well, a lot of people thought it was a big deal.
It was a bad movie, but she wasn't miscast.
Okay.
It's a woman of a certain age who can sing. What do you mean?
I'm not going to get into this.
What a crazy thing to say. Meryl Streep will come there and kick your ass.
Now, that would be a big deal.
I see what you're doing.
That's right. I was trying to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, we told you we'd talk about One Direction, and here we go. One Direction's TV special on NBC. It may have been a non-event in the ratings, but the boy band of the moment is tops where it counts, and that is on tour. For the first time in history, according to Pollstar, the biggest concert draw in the world for an entire year was One Direction, a new band. Historically, the number one draw has always been a legacy act with a long history behind them. Not today. Harry Styles and friends grossed $282 million around the world. They did it with one of the lowest ticket prices, averaging $82, and one of the highest averages in actual ticket sales, with some 78,000 screaming fans at each venue. Justin Timberlake was number two, but far back with $184 million in ticket sales, and the Rolling Stones were number three with $165 million in grosses. Of course, the Stones only did 25 shows, but they also had the highest average ticket price of nearly $200. Worldwide concerts are a $20 billion business and more vital to the health of the music industry than ever before, thanks to disappearing album sales, which we will talk about in a moment. Big Deal or Big Whoop.
It's a big deal. Wow, the first time in history. I didn't know that. No new act has been the biggest concert draw of the year before worldwide. It's the first time it's ever happened. That's kind of amazing. I mean, they've been tracking this stuff for decades, going back at least into the 70s, if not the 60s. So that's kind of cool. I mean, I have to say, I found the new album a little disappointing. It didn't have a lot of great singles like the first two or three. There's still a good song or two, but it was not quite as good as the last two. Album sales were a little bit down. Fans came out for the concerts, but you know, they may have just passed their peak. I fear this is the sort of the nature of boy bands, but we'll have to see how they do. Maybe they're in it for the long haul. Who knows? But what I love is that they did it with low ticket prices and lots of fans. That's a great way to build a long-term business for your band and for your brand. Let people come to shows. Let them, don't jerk them around and charge them $1 billion. Let them have fun going to a concert, and they're going to come back the next time you come to town.
You know, in 1999, I paid, I think it was like $95 to see Bruce Springsteen.
Outrageous.
He never
charged huge prices either. He still doesn't.
I think the last time I saw him, I paid $97 to give you some. Yeah, I mean, he was
held the line.
Yeah, he towed the line, and he was a little tad high in 1999, but he just stayed the course.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And great show.
That's true, and he's got more fans than ever. Every year, Oscar campaigns include some mudslinging with fans of one movie trying to badmouth their competitors by insisting it's not historically accurate or it's just for kids or whatever they can come up with. Foxcatcher is in the unenviable position of having the guy the movie is based on suddenly blasting it on social media. Olympic gold wrestler Mark Schultz, whose brother was murdered by John DuPont, apparently freaked out when he realized the movie implied that DuPont may have had a sexual interest in Mark, or even that something happened between them. Schultz detailed all sorts of discrepancies in the film that he felt belittled his career, but saved his real ire for the gay subtext pointed out by critics. Schultz said of director Bennett Miller, and this is a quote, "Your career is over. You think I can't do it? Watch me." He also said, "I hate Bennett Miller," as well as, "I hate everything that scum touches. Everything." And in case, you know, you missed the point, in talking about the movie he'd previously praised and attended the premiere of in Cannes, Schultz said, "I hate it, I 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 hate it." Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. I actually kind of think it might help the movie. Does that make any sense?
Yes, although, I feel kind of bad. I feel kind of bad. We just kind of gave the ending away, didn't we, by saying...
Yeah, no, it's based on a true story. Obviously, he's got some issues as far as homophobia. He's like really furious. Like, that's disgracing and disgusting. It's like, dude, first of all, how dumb were you not to notice it when you first saw the film? And secondly, they've been very respectful of him. They have not overreacted to him. And it might make people go, huh, maybe there's something more interesting in this movie than I thought. You know, like, oh, that sounds a little interesting. A little, you know, just sort of it's not a little hagiography, like perhaps Unbroken is. It may have a little grit to it, and it's not just some sort of thing. So, you know, it may actually, in my mind, bizarrely help the film. But it's a very sad case because they tried to make him feel part of the process. He was very supportive of them in the movie. He saw it and had no problem. But then when critics said, yeah, that's kind of creepy when John DuPont sort of, and he's like, what? So clearly not the most progressive of guys.
Well, and quite honestly, there is nothing. The subtext is all geared toward John DuPont and not the wrestler.
Well, a little bit. The brother just said, hey, what's going on with you two? And you could possibly think that perhaps something happened that we're not shown, but it's not really, that's very vague at best. And you would really be bringing that to the movie.
That's
but,
right.
You know, clearly he's very unhappy at the suggestion of anything of the sort. So too bad. Of course, it's his life. And, you know, he did have other complaints that I thought were more valid, but they weren't complaints that he expressed before. He seemed perfectly happy with the film. So it's just when a critic said, yeah, that's a weird gay subtext, that he went, what?
Yeah. So I didn't see anything about that.
Doesn't make him look too good, I'm afraid. So it's very sad because it's obviously a tragedy in his life, and they tried to make a respectful film, but it's a creepy story.
Yes,
you know,
there's
no getting around that it's creepy. The guy killed his brother for no reason. So very sad. But maybe it helps the Oscar campaign. That's the Hollywood silver lining to human tragedy.
What's the hot new format in radio? It's old school hip hop. Yes, with listeners.
It's tricky to rock a rhyme. It's rock a rhyme. And rock in time. It's tricky. Tricky.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were going to rap.
By the way, what's that saying? Keep your something or other. Day job. That's the word I was looking
for. Oh, ouch. Yeah. Okay.
I'm kidding. I kid. Well, with listeners flocking to online stations and streaming services, radio stations are struggling to grab attention as we all know. In Houston, a station that branded itself Boom figured out a classic hip-hop format, a modern spin on classic rock. Well, that did the trick. They went heavy on LL Cool J, the Notorious B.I.G., and Missy Elliott, and their ratings exploded. Probably,
I'm going to knock you out.
Well, also, their name was Boom.
Exactly.
Other stations that were floundering did the same with positive results. The only fly in the ointment? It's proven so popular that three or four stations in some markets are trying it, thus canceling each other out. The mania for this new genre will surely slow down, but just like oldies and classic rock and soft rock, classic hip-hop looks like it's here to stay. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I am Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello to the black, to the white, to the red, to the brown, to the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, boogie to the boogie to uptown, the boogie to be.
Okay, I take it back. Actually, you should quit your day job.
I would say it's a big deal in a way. It shows the maturation of hip hop and how long it's been around that there can be a classic hip hop radio station. Makes perfect sense. Every type of format has this. It was time for hip hop. Very logical, very obvious. I'm not surprised it's a success, and I'm sure it'll be here as long as we're listening to music.
Cable channel CNBC has dumped the Nielsen rating company. Instead, they've switched to Cogent Reports, which is already a trusted source of info in the financial industry. Cogent promises to measure ad sales effectiveness and get a better snapshot of CNBC's audience outside the home, such as, say, airport lounges and hotels, where CNBC garners a lot of eyeballs. CNBC's ratings via Nielsen are actually up this year, but that's due mostly to reruns of ABC reality show Shark Tank. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I kind of think it's a really big deal. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, CNBC, if it was another network, I would say it's a bigger deal. But it certainly shows that there's a chink in the armor over at Nielsen.
Yeah, I mean, this has been decades where people are complaining, hey, you're missing kids who watch TV in college dorms. You're missing people who watch in bars. You're missing people who go over to their friends' homes. There's a huge amount of television watching that's not being captured. And now, of course, that's exploded even more with video streaming and Hulu and online and all this stuff. So Nielsen really has had a long time to try and deal with this issue, and they have not done a good job. They're just sort of tentatively trying to do something. And it's a hard technical challenge, but come on, you know, this has been decades now. And I think, yeah, you know, CNBC, that's absolutely the right person to say, you know what, we want better. If they can convince their advertisers to pay more based on what Cogent shows them, and it's an outside company that people already know and trust in the financial world, so they can make a good argument. Hey, they're a third-party source. It's not our patsy. And if they're making this statement and this argument, you can trust them as a reliable source. You know, that could work. I mean, look at ESPN. That's the number one channel on cable TV. You know, there was just a report out that that's the number one most watched show on cable. And you know what? They have a ton of missed audiences as well. You know, sports bars and things like that. So you look at CNBC and the biggest, you know, a really driven channel towards demographics of wealthy people. And you got something like ESPN, which reaches a ton of people. They're both at the different ends of the spectrum of Nielsen ratings, but they both will benefit from a better job of capturing eyeballs. And Nielsen just isn't doing the job.
Well, you mentioned ESPN. You know, Dish announced, I think it was yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
At the start of CES.
We talked about it before, right?
The fact that they are going to sell subscribers or basically they're going to sell.
No, they're going over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they 12 channels, $20. One of those channels is ESPN.
That's right, because they're partnered with Disney. So you've got a lot of Disney channels like ESPN. They're not going to have the four major networks, and that's the thing that they need in order to truly make it a service. But yeah, you can just buy it over the top. You don't have to subscribe to Dish. You pay $20. You get this batch of bundled channels. It's what, you know, what people said they want. My sister was complaining. She said, oh, she saw a guy on TV say, no. People think they want bundled television. They want, you know, a la carte, but they really don't. And she's scoffing at that. And I was like, well, yeah, what people really want is competition, because they're perfectly happy with their package of 500 cable channels. They just don't want to pay $120 for it.
That's right. That's, you know, absolutely correct.
I actually do think that the range of shows, that there's a lot more channels. I guess they always said people usually watch about 8 or 10 or 12 channels,
17
right?
is like the most. Yeah, like
the
17,
magic, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? Every time a new show pops up, it's not necessarily the channel you've watched before. You may not have watched FX until Archer. You didn't watch the Food Network until whatever. So I think there's actually more dipping into other channels than people realize. They didn't watch AMC until, you know, Mad Men came on, a lot of people. I did, because I had old movies.
That's right.
You know? So I think actually they do like bundled, but they want cheaper bundled. They want competition so that it's not so darn expensive. And maybe some people will be happy with a smaller service like this, as long as it includes the number of big channels they want, like ESPN and the networks. So, you know, it's what they got to do it. They're partnering with someone. They're going to get it out there. People get used to the idea. And then the people who provide internet are going to freak out.
That's right. Vinyl. Well, it continues to show traction as a niche format for music, growing by leaps and bounds in the U.S. and the U.K. and presumably the rest of the world as well. In the UK, vinyl format sales topped 1.3 million copies, which is six times its sales just 5 years ago. In the US, vinyl sales have quadrupled in the past 5 years, hitting 9.2 million copies, which is the most ever in the SoundScan era, which began in 1993. Of course, by then, compact
CDs were
Yeah.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to curse.
Thank you very much. Of the 10 top-selling vinyl format albums in the UK, five were legacy releases like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, Led Zeppelin's debut, two albums from Oasis, and the classic debut by the Stone Roses. Big Giller, Big Whoop.
That's a great album, the Stone Roses. Those are all good albums, but that Stone Roses album is great. It's a big whoop, right?
Yeah.
I mean, vinyl is about less than 4% of album sales. The reason it looks more impressive is because album sales are so low.
Yeah.
So let me not joke. 10 million copies is a lot when only one album, was it one album or two albums sold more than a million copies this year?
I think it's something like that. Yeah.
Three albums. So 10 million copies is a lot in that context. It's just a sad reflection of how few albums are actually being sold. But again, it's less than 4% of album sales. People are not suddenly flocking back to vinyl. They never will. But hey, it's a real, real niche format. It matters. It's proving good. And you know what? I was in St. Pete, Florida, and they had just pulled out an old vinyl, all their old vinyl, and they had a turntable that someone gave them. And there we were playing some old vinyl LPs, you know? So it's a novelty, but it's pretty good sound. And, you know, it's fun.
Did the person who put the needle on the record say, I couldn't find the tray where the record would go in?
No, because it was the dad.
Oh, okay.
If it was the kids, maybe.
I actually, one of my kids said, what's a compact disc?
Well, that's funny.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God.
That really makes you feel old. You know, we actually were sitting around at the dinner table talking, and one of the couples there had a son who's, I don't know how old he is. I shouldn't say. I'm going to say he's a teenager. I'll leave it at that. But we were talking about the internet. We all started to describe the first time we dealt with the internet. He's over there going, looking at us like, how old are we? You know, I'm going, I remember in the 70s when I went to the campus of FAU and they showed the game where, you know, we did a little text game where it says, you are in a cave. There is a sword on, you know, pick up sword, you know, and then it would lead you through that whole game.
Yeah.
You know, and this poor kid was looking at us like we were 170 years old. I said, next week, we're going to tell you about the first time we saw television.
We used to sit around the campfire telling stories. That was our only entertainment.
Exactly.
Well, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg is pulling an Oprah. How's that? Well, he's launching a book club. He's pledging to read one book every 2 weeks for the next year. That's a total of 26 books, many of which will focus on differing cultures, beliefs, and of course, technology. Up first, The End of Power by Moses Naim, which it's subtitled, get this, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. I'd like to subtitle it The World's Longest Subtitle. That's a lot of words. Publishers Weekly says the book, which has sold less than 6,000 copies to date, is number one in all of its subcategories on Amazon. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
What?
I mean, it's cute. It's nice. You know, the Times actually has different figures in the Publishers Weekly. They say the book has sold 20,000 copies, including 4,500 eBooks. And that was before Zuckerberg made his announcement. And they claim it has sold another 4,500 copies on eBook since that announcement. And they say it shot up to number 19 on the Amazon list, to which I say, that's not very high. You know, Oprah was selling a million copies of a book when she would pick it for her book club. So, you know, if you're selling 5,000, 10,000 copies, you know, you're moving the dial for that book. It matters. It's nice. I'm glad he's doing it, but it's not actually necessarily setting the world on fire. And the Times wrote a story. Oh, Mark Zuckerberg is already selling books. Like, no, you just did a story about how he's not really selling books. 5,000 copies is not a lot of copies. You know, he's got 30 million followers on Facebook. That means 0.001% actually bought a copy of the book.
That's actually probably the industry average. There you go. HBO's Game of Thrones, one of the most restricted and most popular TV shows on the planet, remains the number one most pirated TV show in the world. Now, what do we mean by restricted? We mean unless you have a paid TV service and unless you pay a premium for HBO, you have to wait around about a year after the episodes originally air just for the chance to rent or buy them.
Legally.
Legally, of course. Yeah. Also, different countries have different release dates for the new seasons. So even if you do pay for TV and pay for HBO, in some countries you'll be reading spoilers before you even get a chance to watch it legally. Or you'll hear the spoilers from us when we do Big Deal, Big Whoop.
The Red Wedding!
The result? Game of Thrones is pirated all over the world, with BitTorrent alone showing 8 million downloads of episodes in 2014. The Walking Dead and The Big Bang Theory are also widely pirated, but since they're far more widely available, they max out at 4.2 million and 3.6 million, respectively. One of the, on the movie side, The Wolf of Wall Street and Frozen were the big winners, or should I say the big losers, with Wolf getting downloaded some 30 million times. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's obviously a big deal. I do think it's a valid point that because it's so hard to watch the show without jumping through multiple hoops, that's why it is more pirated than other TV shows. But I'm surprised at how little it's pirated. Aren't you, in a way?
Yes.
I mean,
no.
Wolf of Wall Street is 30 million copies, and Game of Thrones, which has 10 episodes a season, and everybody's talking about it, and it's an ongoing conversation. You think people would want to catch up or watch it or check it out, and you really, you know, you got to go to a lot of work to check it out. If you want to do it legally, you got to wait a year, you got to spend money on Blu-ray or DVD or renting it, and it's only 8 million copies. That's 8 million total copies on BitTorrent for all those episodes. That's only 800,000, average of 800,000 downloads per episode. That seems pretty low to me.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't know why that is, actually. That it would be interesting to kind of dig deeper into those numbers.
Well, obviously, it's BitTorrent only, so there are other sites, but that's a good indicator of popularity versus a movie like Wolf of Wall Street, which I'm a little surprised that's the most downloaded movie of the year as well. But, you know, it's illegal. It's pirating. Some other things that they're clamping down on is like Netflix. They're trying to stop people from using VPNs in order to trick them into thinking, oh, I'm actually in the U.S. So people who can't access some of these shows, they go online, they set up a fake web address, so it looks like they're in the U.S. located, and therefore they're legally able to subscribe to Netflix. That's
right.
Why when they're in Australia, when they're coming into that market, they're going to find out there's actually a lot of people who already subscribe to Netflix by using this little trick. They're clamping down on that. So, you know, there's all this piracy and all this stuff going on. Let people do it legally. And they're going to jump through hoops sometimes to do it sort of legally. I'm putting that in quotes. When you're subscribing to Netflix, you're paying money. And if you don't let them, they'll do it illegally.
Yeah,
so maybe the message is, you know, maybe you should make it a little more available. But, of course, that's their wildly profitable business model that HBO has.
Well, and even like the interview, when I was looking at the torrents and the comments on the torrents for that, as I was monitoring that Christmas day, a lot of the people downloading were in foreign countries saying,
right,
I would have paid for this, but I can't get it in my country.
Yeah, of course. And of course, Game of Thrones, they had sort of a neat announcement as well. They're going to be shown in IMAX. They've taken the last two episodes of season four and they've, you know, spruced them up. And they're going to be showing them in IMAX theaters. People can pay money to go see them and then see a sneak preview of season five. So it's the first TV show to be shown theatrically in IMAX theaters.
In IMAX, and, yes. Not in
Right. What do you mean?
Well, I thought you were going to say theatrically in a cinema, which would not have been accurate.
Yeah, there's Doctor Who and other stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And
so,
quite
yes.
Honestly, I mean, I do not have Showtime, okay?
Showtime?
Showtime. Just follow me here. The Nick is a Showtime show.
Ah, yes.
Steven Soderbergh's, I think there were like 8 or 13 episodes. Great show. Interesting show. I know not a lot of people liked it. I would have paid to go to a marathon of The Nick, or like, you know, over a couple of days, pay to, you know, to go see that in theaters. Don't want to subscribe to Showtime, but I would have paid
for it. I'm
not
going to go to a theater and watch 10 episodes of a TV show.
Well, I, you know.
That's not happening.
Okay. Well, maybe
it's
just me.
That's not a very good. I mean, it would be, you know, I mean, you would pay to have access to stream it online. Isn't it on Netflix?
I don't know.
I was with someone and they were watching it. I hope it wasn't illegal. I didn't mean to. I saw an episode. It was pretty good.
You're going to have to rip your eyeballs out of your head.
Ouch. Yeah, I didn't mean to. Oh my God, I'm a pirate. Arrgh.
Well, Bono posted online about the year 2014, which was filled with more highs and lows than most of the rockers' wildly successful career. They had the high of giving away the new U2 album to the world in a grand gesture, and the low of some people being actually miffed about, you know, receiving that album for free. They had the high of great reviews and a new tour in the works, and the low of Bono's bicycling accident. He now says he may never be able to properly play guitar again, posting online that, quote, the band have reminded me that neither they nor Western civilization are depending on this. So I guess the band is saying, look, just put the guitar down. Don't worry about it. Their tour will begin in 2015, but Bono did say that recovery has been more difficult than I thought. Yeah, no duh. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course, especially about the guitar. I saw just the headline and all our reaction was like, that's like the Edge saying he'll never sing again.
Yes.
Like, yes, he can sing, but that's not what he's known for.
Correct.
So, yeah, but it's no fun. He says he writes songs on the guitar. He likes to be able to strum. So, you know, he's a musician. So it's kind of a sad thing, but at least he has a good sense of humor about it. And thank God he's not more seriously hurt.
Yes, that's true.
Though, obviously, it's a lot more, you know, it was a bad accident.
Yes, very bad, actually.
Yeah, wow.
Especially the head trauma, but
yeah, three surgeries, wasn't it? Two or three operations?
I think four, actually.
And he's never going to be able to play the guitar again. That's just, it's very sad.
Indeed.
And that's, of course, with the best possible medical care in the world.
Yes. He was right there at New York Presbyterian, New York Hospital. Yeah, so.
Well, wherever he was going to get the best medical care in the world.
That is true.
Yeah.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about, we already talked about the box office, movie box office. We're going to talk about music sales.
And this is perfect from U2 because they decided to give away the new album because they said, you know what? Album sales are not where we're making money. And if we give away our album to hundreds of millions of people, maybe that will bring more people to one of our concerts, which is where their big bucks are right now.
That's right. And total album sales dropped 11.2% to 257 million units, according to Nielsen Music.
That's North America, right?
This is North America only, yes, which is the only numbers we have. If we had other numbers, we would be more than happy to share them. IFPI will probably be letting us know about those numbers a little later on in January or February. Track sales declined 12.5% to 1.1 billion. And are down,
units.
Yes, and are down 17.5% from the high of 1.3 billion units in 2012.
Okay, you're throwing a lot of numbers at us. Album sales are down. Sales of single tracks are down. You know, more significantly, about 250 million albums were sold, whether that's digitally or physical, and about 1.1 billion individual tracks were purchased, and that's down a little bit from 1.3 billion, which is the record in 2012. That's the all-time record, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, okay, it's down from the all-time record. That's not necessarily bad, but we don't have a chart of, you know, digital sales are so new, you can't really compare going back more than a decade because they were just beginning then.
Yeah, and more, you know, consumers are getting hardware that can play digital tracks.
Yes, so, like phones?
Like phones and iPods, etc.
Nobody gets an iPod anymore.
That's true. Actually, they don't make them anymore. The classic iPod is no longer made because they couldn't get the parts. Although, it's almost 13 years to the day since Steve Jobs introduced iTunes.
But the big savior for the music biz, because, you know, the album sales are down, single sales are down, concert tours are doing okay, but the record labels don't make money usually off concert tours, not necessarily. It depends on the deal they have with the artist, but historically, that was where the artist was in control. But they say, is streaming killing the music business? And Billboard says, no, it's not.
Yeah, they say on-demand streaming rose 54% last year to 164 billion songs that were streamed. Again,
so people bought 1 billion tracks and they streamed 164 billion tracks.
Yes.
Wow.
And that is an increase of 57.5 billion tracks. It's an equivalent increase in album sales. They're trying to equate it to 56.1 million units. So
I don't get that. What do you mean?
They're trying to say that all that streaming, that 56.1 million units.
Right. They went from about 100 billion songs being streamed to 164 billion songs being streamed. So it's about a 50% increase in streaming last year. And they say that increase in streaming is equal to as if they'd sold 56 million albums.
Correct. Money wise.
Money wise?
Yes.
No, that's not money wise. That's just they're saying. Each track has about 12 songs on it, and therefore, I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, that's actually a good question. How they track that?
I know you gave a figure to me before that a lot of the labels quote, and that's
actually
that,
and they tell you right here: track equivalent albums (TEA), a combination of album and track sales. So they actually tell you.
So they're saying about sales. Yes, but that doesn't mean it's money. I mean,
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying that just because you're doing
they're
this,
just saying if you sold 50 million albums or that would be about 12 tracks an album. That would only take you to 500 million tracks, and that's we're looking at 160 billion tracks. So that's 100 times more than the actual equivalent. But you gave a figure before to say that record labels claim, hey, as far as money is being concerned, to make the same amount of money we make from one album sale, we would have to have people stream 1,400 tracks. So if you stream 1,400 different songs, or you just stream one song 1,400 times because you really love Blurred Lines, that brings in the same amount of money as one album sale.
Correct, yes.
Right? So that is 1,400. That would mean for every single you sold, you'd have to stream 1,400. You've got 10 songs on an album, 12 songs on an album. That means you'd have to stream 100 times as many songs as you buy.
Yes.
Right? If you sell 12 songs, that's like streaming 1,200 songs. So that means your album sales are 50 million copies, and that means your streaming is 100 times that is 505 billion.
So just to kind of put a sum on it.
This is completely, yeah. I mean,
You make less money streaming. That's the gist of it. Streaming
right,
makes less money.
I don't understand how they're claiming to equivalent. I mean, if they say it's 1,400 tracks, that's more than 160. That's more than 56 million units. I mean, it doesn't add up.
Well,
they're saying, "Oh, we streamed an extra 50 billion tracks." That's as if we sold 50 million albums.
Yeah, I don't know how they've done that. Well, I'll have to look into that. I thought I did with the track equivalent albums, but I'll have to look into that a little further.
So they're saying, "Okay, we only sold 250 million albums this year, but we streamed so much that's like selling another 50 million albums."
Right.
So it's just almost as if we sold 300 million albums last year.
Correct.
Which would be a leap over the year before.
Usually,
so they're saying streaming is making up for album sales, except it doesn't bring in as much money.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to get at, is that, yes, okay, great, but not so great, because the whole kind of stereotype now, the cliche of trading analog dollars for digital dimes, this is a perfect example of that.
Right, and they have a lot of other stuff that isn't great. I mean, there's declines in a lot of genres. Rock is down 9%. R&B was down 25%. Hip-hop was down 24%. This is all compared to last year. So every year, you know, it depends on what artists release albums, what's hot right now. Country was down a little bit. Country was down to 8%. You know, so you can't look at one year, like we said about movies. You know, but overall, the music biz, you have to look at the whole pie. Look at concert sales. Look at streaming. Look at album sales. Streaming is making up for some of the album losses, but not nearly as much as it should be.
Right. And one of their points is that, yes, these are year-over-year figures. However, note the trend lines. They're down year-over-year. Like, year after year, they're going in the wrong direction. So the trend, it's trending downward.
But not streaming. Streaming is trending up.
Correct. That's
I mean, it increased 54% last year.
Yes.
But what the problem is that they're not charging enough for it, and not enough money is getting to the songwriters and the artists and the musicians.
Which is exactly why Taylor Swift, when she released her album 1989, which sold 3.66 million copies last year in the United States alone, she said, yeah, I don't want it on Spotify. You know?
Yeah, a lot of artists say, hey, I'd like to have, when I put out a new album, I'd like to have it be on the premium service.
Right.
For all those streaming sites, because, you know, I make a little bit more money and people have to pay more, and therefore there's more money to be had. But I don't want to make it free day one, which, you know, hey, that makes sense.
Yeah. And they're now talking about staggered releases, you know, where there's
Just
like in movies. So it just goes to show you, hey, it's a product. And one way to market and sell a product is through these, you know,
windowing.
Yes. Distribution channels. And distribution channels often have different types of access at different periods of time. So just like every other product in the world.
And what was the best-selling album of 2014 in North America? What album sold more copies than any other album?
I think it was 1989, the Taylor Swift album.
That's right. It sold 3.66 million copies. It just edged out the Disney soundtrack Frozen, which sold 3.53 million copies, but is far more beloved by little girls everywhere.
That's true. And they're saying...
I shouldn't say that Taylor Swift isn't beloved too. Of course she is. But there you go.
Yeah, and the best-selling track last year was?
I assume Let It Go.
No, Happy.
Oh, my God.
6.41 million tracks. Now, that was a Pharrell Williams hit. It sold 3.3% greater than sales of 2013's top track, Blurred Lines, by Robin Thicke.
Why would you say something like 3.3%? It sold about the same amount as last year's big hit, Blurred Lines.
Right. Well, I was trying to point out that Pharrell Williams has had a good run since he was a part of Blurred Lines.
That's true.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get Pharrell Williams to create a new theme song for us for 2015.
Ah, but then I would have to change our outro where I mentioned that the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. How do you like that? I've memorized it now.
Very good.
Now, you know, since we're kind of wrapping up the show, there's a few other things I should probably tell you that you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they aggregate or give podcasts away for free. That's usually where you can find us. And please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show on those aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or ways to contact us with feedback or comments or news stories you think we should cover. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like our Facebook page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All this information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week, it's something different. What is it this week, Michael?
It's myloveisadjustedforinflation.com.
Wow. You know, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try michaelgiltz.com? Head on over to the huffingtonpost.com or maybe even bookfilter.com. You can find some of his work there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. Hey, maybe you should actually write our new theme song.
It's going to be hip hop if I do.